Hello and welcome, fellow awesomeologists, to Awesomeology. I'm Sue.
And I'm Ben. And in this episode, we're welcoming Eric Coriel, founder of Core Connections LLC, accountable teams coach and author of the book Revolutionizing Teamwork. Welcome, Eric.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Well, we are so excited to talk to you. Welcome to our show. As I said before we started recording, I did give you a little bit of my fangirl energy via email. It's amazing to be talking to you face to face. We did a whole year-long series of our podcast last year, talking about your book and how we could apply the things that we learned from your book to our team. But before we jump into that, we want to hear from you and talk about your career journey. You have a pretty interesting journey from being a career person to being a coach and writing that book. So tell us what led you to that, and how do you use those concepts now to help other leaders?
Yeah, it ended up being more of an accident than anything. So to make what seems like a long story short, got a degree in economics, had no idea what to do with it. So I got a job as a buyer at a medical device manufacturer, and we were a small company, but we worked with the big boys, right? The Baxters and the Abbotts, and they were so dysfunctional just because of their size. This is back in the 80s. We started doing crazy things, trying to make it work, like cross-functional teams, things that I don't think we even called it that at that point, but we were just trying to make it work, right? And we really struggled to get those teams to work. And it was at that point, I heard a speaker talk about what drives human behavior inside a group setting. And I listened to that, and I'm like, this guy's kind of crazy. And then I went back to work, and everything he talked about played out in front of my eyes. So I took the tape cassette, stuck it back in the deck, and like, wow, there's something here. And what that did more than anything is just made me aware and conscious of teams just don't happen, right? So I started trying some different things, and it really kind of came to a head when I became president. I was pretty young, totally over my head, but ran into this problem of, A, people started telling me what they thought I wanted them to say as opposed to what I knew they felt, because we used to go to lunch and talk all the time. But then the bigger issue was I just wasn't very good at holding people accountable. I wanted everyone to be happy, get along, you know, like me, and I just wasn't very good at that, right? And so all that kind of led to, gee, there's got to be a different way of managing accountability. And so that's when I started to figure it out. That company ended up getting sold. Meanwhile, I'd met another CEO, and he and I were just polar opposites. I was a real wimpy, can't wait to sing kumbaya. He was a benevolent dictator, right? And he said, gee, can you come up here and help us do the team thing you kind of did at your company? I said, sure. And I said, that won't take long, right? And he said, and in return, I'll give you a spine. And I'm like, deal. So ended up spending 6 years there. And it was there that I really kind of, through a lot of trial and error, trying different things, realized, you know what? Getting teams to function and become accountable is very predictable and repeatable, right? So left there, ended up doing a startup as someone else owned it, but kind of helped him grow that startup. And that was fun because I could do it from ground zero. And sure enough, it worked. Although the economy didn't help, 2008 came and kind of stuck a knife in the business. And it was at that point, a CEO in Minnesota called me up and said, hey, can you help us do what you did with this other company? I'm like, well, I can try, right? And that's what got me into the consulting world and found out that it was a lot of fun to be able to take all the lessons you've learned and help other leaders, so they don't make all the mistakes I made, right? And so for the past 15 years, this is what I've been doing, is I just get to work with hundreds of different organizations, helping leaders create functional accountable teams and more now helping them rethink the organizational structure. And the good part for my end is I still get to learn. I mean, with every client I take on, I'm still learning, but then I can also share. So it's been the most satisfying part of my career.
Super cool. I have like the first question that comes to mind for me, because you use the word repeatable. And then at the end there, you talked about how you're still learning, things are still changing and evolving. What's that been like over the years with those career changes with, every team is different. Every human is different. So like all the personalities and everything, it's interesting to me. I mean, you wrote a book about it trying to, I imagine one of the goals of that book is to help prove its repeatability and those kinds of things. But how does that live alongside just the very natural differences that happens with humans and teams, right?
That's a great question. This so the predictable and repeatable part is really understanding what's required to get a group of people truly to function like a team, and then what's required to get them to become accountable. And that is universal in my experience across all generations, across all organizations. And that was the stuff that I when I first heard that speaker, got me thinking around really what makes that happen. Because I'm convinced most teams that we call teams, especially inside business organizations, aren't really teams. We take a group of people, they report to someone, we call them a team, but if you really pay attention, very rarely do they function like a team. So the predictable and repeatable part is understanding, okay, what needs to happen to get them to function like a team, right? And that's some of the stuff I outlined in the book, right? Some of it's obvious. You need a clear purpose, you need measurements, you need competent people, you need capable processes. But probably the biggest aha is, in order to get a group of people to really function like a team, is you got to create a shared faith. And by that, I mean, there has to be this experience of what happens to one happens to all. And that's what gets people to function together under pressure and adversity. If you think about team sports, there's a shared fate. We either win the game together, we lose the game, right? It's built in. But in other environments, especially inside organizations, the shared fate of most teams, honestly, is just surviving the boss. You know, the conversations amongst everybody is like, you won't believe what he said this morning. Oh, yeah, wait to hear what he did yesterday, right? And that'll be the conversation that will gel the team together, right? So learning how to create a meaningful shared fate is kind of instrumental in getting a team to function. The problem is, you can have a functional team, but the leader can still have all the accountability. If you want the functional team to become an accountable team, then that team has got to get good at dealing with their real issues together. And by that, I mean, if there's an issue that's affecting the team's ability to be successful, they have to start dealing with those issues. Good news is, most issues aren't real, right? If someone's got bad breath, you don't need to bring the whole team together and talk about their bad breath, right? But if someone's not equally invested in the team, that's a real issue. If someone's not behaving by the values we agreed to, that's a real issue. If someone is not performing, that's a real issue. And I don't know about you guys, but when I got into the working world, I was literally told, Eric, you praise in public and you criticize in private. And we don't talk about performance together as a group. Yet if you ever played on a high school sports team, you know, what was performance talked about? Well, it was in front of everybody. And it was normal and natural. But in business, we preach and do the opposite. We get together in meetings and we work hard not to talk about our real issues. We talk about our real issues in the meeting, after the meeting, in our favorite subgroups, bars, bathrooms, hallways. So the key to getting a team to become accountable is getting them good at doing that, right? So that's what I will call the predictable and repeatable part of really understanding teams. The learning comes from a lot of it, I believe, is actually generational. As these new generations are entering the workforce, they're just coming in with very different perspectives around work and how we interact and all those things. And, you know, like an old leader, I mean, my first reaction is that they just don't get it. And now I'm like, no, they get it. And they bring a lot of really special things, but so does my generation, the generation precedes me. And so really getting these generations to work together and value the uniqueness that they all bring to the table is underpinning a lot of the still the learning. So there's that piece of the equation. And the other big piece of the equation is, and this is, I'll abbreviate this, but if you think about business, pretty much everything has changed, what, in the past 5 years, 10 years, 100 years? I'd probably argue in the past 100 years, everything has changed, with two exceptions. The way we structure our organizations and the way we manage accountability. We are in the early 1900s and companies started to grow in size. We had to figure out how to organize everybody. And we adopted the military model, right? You know, generals, officers, soldiers, thinking, telling, doing. And to this day, that's how most organizations structure themselves. And the reason they do that is that's how we manage accountability. If someone's not performing, the expectation is the boss deals with it. And that's just it creates very upward looking organizations, but that's the what I call parent led hierarchical accountability model, right? Well, even the military has figured out that structure doesn't work. They're changing, but inside businesses haven't. We tried a lot of different things. We tried matrix. We tried holacracy. None of those work. But what I have found is if you can learn to manage accountability through teams, then you can rethink your organizational structure. So I spend probably about half my time helping leaders rethink how they manage accountability inside the organization, going from a leader-led hierarchical model to a much more team-based managing accountability. And if you get good at doing that, now you can entirely rethink your org chart. So those are the two big areas around which still learning, you know, still growing, the impetus for change.
So one of the things that most stuck out to me, now I, as I also mentioned to you outside of this, I took part in the Wisconsin Credit Union League Leadership Institute, and you spoke for one of our sessions. And one of the things that really stood out to me that you said, and you mentioned it just now too, is that personal accountability sort of, we think as leaders that our job is to hold people accountable, but we are not holding them accountable. We are holding ourselves accountable. And we are taking on all of their junk and letting them and letting them be not essentially not accountable. We're doing that buck stops here thing. And we are preventing them by doing that. We prevent them from learning. We prevent them from growing. We prevent them from being good leaders because they never learn to be accountable on their own and in their own job. Right. I mean, we only talked about this for the last year, Eric, so I just, I will happily regurgitate any point that we talked about. It was huge to hear that, because when we started our journey with our team with this, I think Ben and I both thought we had this really sort of, you know, we have a structure where he is executive director and I lead our creative team. And so we have a hierarchy on paper, but I think we really felt like we had a flat practice, you know, that in the model where, oh, you know, we're all collaborating and we're all very even. And it took some self-reflection to realize that part of that was an illusion, that I said, you know, that, you know, the team is accountable for their own actions and, you know, whatever, but it was me holding them and Ben, it was me holding them accountable, Ben holding me accountable, or, you know, reaching to the team and holding them accountable. It wasn't them feeling that accountability. So that was a big epiphany for us.
That was a big epiphany for me, because I was told really early on in my career, I had a problem employee. And my boss walked in my office one day and goes, Eric, you just got to hold them accountable. Okay, cool. Like, how do you do that? Right. And if you really think about it, and I'll oversimplify it, but what is the process of holding somebody accountable? Well, you start by setting expectations. You make sure they understand what needs to be done. You help make sure they have all the things they need to do it. You make sure they understand the importance, incentivize, put measurements and goals in place, give them feedback. Well, if that doesn't work, then you go and you ask questions, you do it for them, you coach, you train, you beg, you cry, you pray, you do whatever it is you can, right? And then if that doesn't work, you give them an ultimatum. If that doesn't work, you liberate them. I mean, that's really kind of simplifying it, but that's the process, right? So I went back and I did all those things until one day it occurred to me, like, at what point did I ever really hold them accountable? Well, you can argue I held them accountable when I let them go, right? But up until that point, who really had the accountability? And what I quickly realized was the answer was me. And just think about it. Who's setting the expectations? The leader. Who's making sure they have what they need to get the job done? The leader. Who sets the goals and gives feedback? The leader. Who coaches, you know, begs, friends, cajoles, all those things. The leader. And so what I've come to realize is that whole notion is a myth, that you can't really hold someone accountable. When someone says, I'm going to hold you accountable, as you said, all it really means is I'm taking the accountability from you and I now have it. I am now responsible for doing things different till the desired results happen. And that's really what it means, accountable, right? And so the whole notion of holding people accountable, what it really does is it just creates very upward-looking organization, because it's my boss that's going to take the accountability if I don't get things. And that was kind of the hope. And now there's another way around which you'd imagine accountability, and that is if the desired results don't happen, the team's deal. And so I really, when I talk about accountability, I talk about it in terms of how you're going to manage it. Is the leader or the team? One of those two, because things are going to go wrong, right? What happens at that point? And it's never one or the other. I mean, I think there's more examples in traditional organizations where the leader's got the bulk of it, right? If you want to create an accountable team, however, the accountable team, the team's got to start taking on the bulk of it. Now, if the team doesn't do it, the leader's got to step back in, right? So it's not just, hey, guess what? I don't have to manage accountability anymore, but I have to put the team in a position so they can do it. And then it's not all on my shoulder. Mm-hmm. And as a leader, I love it because that gives me a chance to do my job. I can develop my next round of leaders. It makes it easier to scale the organization. But on the flip side, as a leader, I hate it because I've got to let go of control. And that is the single biggest impediment in making this a reality. I mean, I spent years trying to get my team to be accountable, but at the end of the day, I wanted all the control. And I finally realized you can't have both, right? It's just like a coach in a sport. You know, players don't get the job done. They can't just run out there and take over and run the next set of plays, right? They've got to coach and help them, you know, become better. Well, in business, when someone doesn't get something done, what's the tendency for the leader to do? Well, I'm going to jump in and I'm going to make the decision. I'm going to solve the problem. I'm going to make sure it gets done on time and all those kind of things. It's one thing if I'm coaching baseball or little league or softball or whatever. It's another thing when it's my paycheck, right? It's my financial future. It's my reputation. So while it sounds great on paper, for most leaders, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, it was terrifying. Because if things don't go well, it reflects on me. So my tendency is to want to go make it happen. So that was kind of the mind shift that I had to go through around really what it means to be hold people accountable.
Super cool. There's so much stuff that you're saying where like I'm remembering like specific conversations that we either had as a team or Sue and I had as individuals where all great intentions, you know, like peeling back the curtain a little bit, I remember some conversations with Sue and I where like specifically our goal was to determine where the buck stopped. Was it with me or was it with her? You know, and good intentions. We were trying to set expectations. We were trying to create clarity for ourselves and for the team. And what we were really doing was sucking all of that accountability up and into ourselves, you know, and not sharing it with the team at all, you know? So. Yeah, bringing back some. This is almost traumatic here. Remembering, not that we're like doing it perfectly today or anything like that, but you know, clearly our time with the book and being really intentional about making change on the team has created change on the team, and those conversations are a distant memory now, which is a good thing.
That's awesome. Good for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you said it was traumatic, Ben, because as he was talking, I was thinking about the decision matrix. I was thinking about how hard it was. Let me just spoil our next, where we're going to transition and talk a little bit about our process. So one of the things we did, maybe one of the first things we did was sit down and write up. And so we're a marketing team. We have a lot of different sort of micro lines of work and micro decisions that the team as a whole has to make. And we sat down and created this huge list of things, all important in their own way. And then as a group, we talked about who gets the final decision on that thing. And that process was a little bit emotional because number one, I jumped in a couple of places that I wasn't 100% comfortable saying, okay, Ben, I'm taking this one. This isn't yours anymore. And then we, like everyone on the team got to watch Ben and I have that moment together, right? And him work through and me work through, like I had to decide that I had the ability to do it, that I should, that it was the right thing to do for me to take that from him. And he had to decide he could let it go. And then, you know, on with the rest of the team, I had to, you know, there were things actually for Ben and I both, we had to be able to say, okay, you handle social media. So we're not going to take that decision. You figure out the spend on that social media. We don't have to tell you anymore because you've done it for 5 years at this point. You know how much we spend. And each one of those decisions, you know, some of it, no doubt we went through and went, ugh, I'm sick of thinking about that thing anyway. So I'm happy to let it go. But there were other, but that feeling of, you know, every time something would go away, there was this small feeling in my heart, like, well, what do I do here then?
Yeah.
If I'm not making all of these micro decisions for people, what's my job?
Right.
And I started to, you know, that was the process of realizing, oh, if I can free this up, then I can help grow my team, and I can help, you know, we're in the process, really, we're 6 years in, we're sort of a startup business. So I can help grow the business, and there's so much more I can do if I let that stuff go. But it was still really hard.
Okay. You summarized it perfectly. That's it. It's awesome, but it's hard.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It is really interesting how freeing it can feel, and also scary, for sure. So yeah, that's Sue gave a very nice segue into sharing a little bit about our process, and the decision matrix was one of those tools or exercises from the book that we put into practice right away. And I would say is probably the most valuable part of the process for us, which is tough to say because there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, even just understanding the idea of shared fate as a team, you know, is a big win for sure. But we kind of consumed the book club style, you know, we kind of took it section by section, had some discussions, made sure that we put some of the tools and exercises into practice along the way. You know, and a lot of that was really just having conversations around some of these topics, things like shared fate, dealing with real issues, you know, breaking the social contract, stuff that, you know, I think everybody on some level knows exists, but maybe we don't get out in the table or, you know, on the table and actually have a conversation, share some of our feelings about, like, how do those things make us feel sometimes, you know, and just incredibly valuable to, you know, it's kind of interesting how we held ourselves accountable to consuming and sharing the book in this way. And as a result, you know, like, habits have changed, processes have changed, the team has changed, you know.
Yeah. Awesome.
I don't know, Sue, if there's anything big that I missed about our process.
There are so many things that I want to talk to Eric about. And I mean, the man has a life. We can't keep him here for the next 12 hours. I think the very first thing, credit to you, Eric, and it was the first thing that hit me, first thing that struck me listening to you in that session. Because I, at the time I was taking that leadership course, I had some frustrations, you know, this is a couple of years ago now, and we were a growing team, and I didn't know what I had to do to help some of the members of our team. Like, I could see this spark in them. I felt that they were capable of more than they were doing. And there was this sense of just phoning it in, getting the minimum acceptable product sort of thing from them sometimes. And right down to, I don't know if they listen. I'm always afraid. Sometimes I'm afraid to say things. Other times I just say things, assuming... if the team listens, they'll just talk to me about it, because if they think it's a real issue on our team, we should talk about it. Yeah. But I was really frustrated because I didn't know how we were going to move on to the next level. And one of the things that you brought up in that session is, if I'm remembering it correctly, and you can correct me, is that the first thing you have to do is believe that the people on your team are creative and capable. And that hit me so hard, because, you know, the first thought in my head is, oh, well, that's the problem. This person that I'm thinking of that I think I have an issue with, that one of those things is missing. So then I really dug into it and went through this mental exercise of, okay, well, is it that they're not creative? Is it that they're not competent? Okay, I actually do think they're creative, and I guess I actually do think they're competent. So if I believe that, then there is another thing missing here. It's not the inherent value of this person, their creativity and their competence. It is something else. And oh, thank God he's still talking, because maybe he'll tell me what it is. And yeah, and it was, you know, that not understanding the team, not understanding the sense of shared fate, not being able to deal with real issues. I mean, I think we were small enough that our real issues were pretty small. But as we continue to grow, we get more diverse personalities. I think things that will get bigger. So it's good that we started having those conversations early while we were still tiny. And that is some, you know, talking about those dealing with real issues. One of the biggest, another big thing, this is just me. This is going to be just a series of me saying a big thing that I learned, a big thing I learned. But one of the things I had done previous supervision before I was in this department. One of the processes of supervision that absolutely sucked my soul dry was that thing of Betty has a problem with Sally because she sees Sally doing something wrong. And so Betty has to go to the boss, tell the boss, Sally's doing this thing wrong. You have to tell Sally. And then as the boss, the way I came up in business, you can't say, hey, Sally, Betty said you did that thing wrong. You have to say, it's come to my attention that someone has noticed that you don't know how to do whatever this, that maybe you're struggling in. And that never made any sense to me, especially because I've never been on a massively big team. So Sally knew Betty was saying that. Everybody knows that somebody has a problem with them. So it was this, it was the waste of time that that artifice took. And to be able to say, hey gang, we don't do that anymore. If you see that somebody doesn't know how to do their job, you have a couple of options. You can go directly to them and say, hey, I noticed you don't know how to do this thing. Can I help? And another option, and maybe something you should do anyway, is to say, hey, we talked, you know, I talked to Betty. She doesn't know how this thing works. Maybe it's a process issue. Maybe we don't have, you know, the right procedures in place. Maybe we don't know why we're doing it at all. And then we talk about it as a team. And there have been a couple, just a handful of things where people have come to me in that same sort of Betty's telling on Sally kind of way, saying, well, I noticed that this person's doing that thing. And to be able to say, okay, so what are we going to do to resolve that? How? What's our next step here? Oh, well, you know, I thought maybe you could. Yeah, yeah, I wasn't the one that noticed it. So let's talk about, is this a real issue? Because if it's a real issue, we should be dealing with it as a team. So let's decide when we are going to deal with this.
I'd probably make a case. There's actually five ways around which they can deal with it.
And holy cow.
If you really pay attention, you'll see this pattern play out every day. And it's almost sequential. If someone is not meeting expectations, right? So what you will watch most people do initially is they ignore it. They avoid it. You know, they work around it. You know, maybe I'll do the job for them, or I'll just hope it gets better. And I think we tend to do that until the anxiety starts to build, because ignoring it's not fixing it, right? And then the other option, which is usually the next option people engage, is we start talking about them behind their back. Have you noticed what's going on with Betty? What do you think about Betty? And we're going to talk about Betty behind her back, right? And we'll do that because it minimizes our anxiety, but again, it ultimately doesn't fix it, which then leads us to option number three, which is almost always, hey, we should take this to the boss, because the expectation is the boss should deal with Betty because that's the boss's job, right? And in my experience, that is the problem-solving process for most teams. We let issues build and fester in option one and two until it becomes significant enough. We then look to the leader to deal with it. The leader deals with it. Great. We move on. If the leader doesn't deal with it to our satisfaction, we tend to go back to one and two, except for this time it's about the leader. If only the boss would deal with Betty, all our problems would go away. And now we'll vent, you know, about how awful, you know, our boss is for not taking care of our problems. And those three options, I will tell you, consume 90 to 95% of most teams' time and energy and effort in dealing with it. And all three of those lead to what I call parent-child organization. Ultimately, we look to the leader to deal with it. Now, as you mentioned, there are two other options. And the first one is that I can go talk directly to Betty and have a what I'll call one-on-one confrontation, or we can learn to do this as a group. And both those options are deep down, I know if I, you know, talk to Betty, she can now do the same thing to me. And that's what I call the psychological contract. And that's the contract that exists on most teams that basically says, look, I won't talk about you and your department's non-performance. You just don't talk about me and mine. And we walk around, you know, thinking everything's safe as long as we don't bring up the real issues. That's why we collude not to talk about our real issues. Instead, we choose 1, 2, and 3. But if you've ever been on a great team, volunteer organization, band, high school sports team, or a work team, whatever, right? Think about what you did when real issues arose, and you're going to realize, yeah, we talk to each other, sometimes one-on-one, sometimes with the whole team present. Right? And that's what healthy teams do. And that's the magic, as I said earlier. Team's going to become accountable. They got to get good at dealing with their real issues together. But because at my core, as a human being, I need to be connected to other people to live, right? I'm terrified to do that because I'm afraid that if I do that, there may be a disconnect, right? But the paradox of it all is the more I do that, the more connected I become to my team members. And that's the cycle you got to break, right? But for most people, myself included, choose to do 1, 2, and 3. And ultimately look to the leader to take care of everything because that's the thing. But here's the crazy thing. When I'll have a group of people in the room, and it's one of my favorite things to do. I'll say, okay, guys, pretend we're a team. I'm on your team. And let's just say I'm sitting on lots of frustration about it. Raise your hand if you want me to choose option number one, which is to ignore it. No one raises their hand. I'm like, okay, well, if you don't want me to ignore it, you must want me to talk behind your back. Option two, raise your hand if you want me to talk behind your back. No one raises their hand. I'm like, okay, well, if you don't want that, you must want me to go to your boss and express my frustration about you to your boss. Raise your hand. You know, no one raises their hand. I'm like, well, then what do you want me to do? And every human being everywhere will say, option number four, come talk to me directly. And that's the double standard that I think exists in business. Double standard is, if you've got a problem with me, I expect you to come talk to me. Four. But if I got a problem with you, well, that's the boss's issue. I shouldn't have to deal with Betty's attitude or non-performance. It's not my job. And it's a double standard. And so when you really think about, and I literally will have clients, I just had this last week, it was priceless. You know, I walked them through all that. And like, oh my gosh, they talked about this issue they had. And like, first we won it and we earned it. Then we chopped the edges back. And then we looked to the boss. And the boss is in the room. He goes, you know, the crazy thing is, once you brought it to my attention, I started by ignoring it. And I talked to other people. Yeah. And it once you start seeing it, you'll see it all the time. But the first three options are child. Option 4 and 5, create adult organizations. But you know, we all know being adults not easy. I love my 22-year-old to death, but her toughest choice every day is what, Fortnite, Pokemon Go, Candy Crush, whatever. It's a lot more rewarding being an adult, but it's harder. You know? Yeah. And so it sounds great on paper. I mean, when I get to share this, people are like, oh wow. But as a leader, I got to let go of control. I may not feel needed. And so when push comes to shove, I'm like, And as a teammate, you know, that's great. I get to make decisions and accountability. But when the time comes, they're like, that's about my pay. So there are forces that fight.
Right. And one of the big conversations we had as a team really early on was about the psychological contract and to say, and we really just wanted to put it out on the table. Like, everybody has to understand, if you do it, they get to do it. Everybody gets to do it. We do. If you feel like you can point it out, somebody else can point it out. We all have to be cool with that. If we can't be cool with that, we have to talk about that. And it was, we have some personalities on our team that, you know, are sort of those still waters that run deep. And you know, in the meeting, they're like, okay, yeah, no, that makes total sense. But you could tell that they really were processing that and thinking about the ramifications.
Yeah, definitely one of the more terrifying parts of the process was just being able to like invite the conflict. Maybe that's not dramatic. Maybe that's just real, you know, but good conflict, right?
Right.
All right.
So your LinkedIn profile says that you help business leaders create adult organizations and escape the parent-child model. You illustrated for us what that parent-child model looks like. So what is the most difficult and the most rewarding part of doing that kind of work?
The hard part is, as a consultant's hard because you can't control it, right? So all you can do is coach and beg and hope and pray, right, for them, right? So that's probably one of the hardest parts of my role is, my job is to do whatever I can to help them get there, but I can't influence it more than that, right? So that's probably the hardest part. Rewarding part is just like a parent, when your kid just takes off, you're like, wow, how cool is that?
You're doing it.
Yeah, and you get a little bit of credit, but not much, right? But that's okay, because you just love the fact that, hey, that they're taking off. And so the most rewarding is when an organization really grabs hold of this and you go back in. And I've literally had people say, Eric, you got to do this in other organizations because I can't quit. I'm never going to go back to an adult parent-child model again. So I need to know there's other companies out there that are doing this, because once you get through all the hard stuff, it's awesome. I mean, I get to come into work every day and be an adult, right? And most people want to do it. And that's kind of what you alluded to before. I come to realize most people don't come to work to suck, right? We all come with but most people come with the best intention to do the best they can. And as a leader, I spent almost all my time and focus on people and process, people and process, people and process. And that's where I put all my time. And that kept me from doing other things, because I'm like, we're not ready. We don't have the right people in the process. And what I've kind of realized is, no, set that aside for now, because a good competence is different in a accountable team than it is in a what I'll call non-functioning team. Competence on a non-functioning team is, can I do my job well? Can I come in and do this really well? But as a team becomes really functional, I still need to be able to do my job, but there's much more of an emphasis, am I a good teammate? Am I willing to put myself out there? Am I willing to be vulnerable? Am I willing to help problem solve? Am I willing to go tell my teammate that I think they can be better because I care enough about them and the success of the team, right? So you won't know that until you kind of jump into the water. We don't know when the water's gonna be hot or cold. So as I said in that training, is like, set that aside for now, jump in, and now we're gonna find out what happens. Right. And so that's usually a big hard part to get the leader to let that go for temporarily. Now, there are situations where you're walking on a team where they're just so fundamentally functioning in 5-year-old kindergarten, you got very little chance. Right. But that's very rare. And I'm a pretty good read on people, and I am constantly surprised how wrong I am by the time they're done. Like, I look at this, the one person, like, you don't have a chance. And they end up being a star. And the other one, I'm like, you got this. And they hit the wall, right? So, the rewarding part is when a team really takes off. And that's just, it's fun. And it's rewarding for the leaders inside the organization. Because so many of my clients come to me when the owner's like, I want to retire, but if I leave or sell, this company's going to fall apart. So I need to change the way we manage accountability. Or all leaders come to say, I feel like I'm the only one awake at 2:00 in the morning, right? So if I can learn to change this, right? And then when they do, and the heart, I mean, I would love to tell you the success ratio is high. It's actually really low. Most people get it. But when it comes time to doing it, the leader just freaks out, or the team members don't step up, right? But when it happens, it's just for everybody. And there'll be some people that may leave along the way. They're like, and you know what? This isn't for me. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It's just not a fit. I had a client that's really taken off of this. This goes back about a year ago, but they've gone up, they're all cross-functional teams, and there's no private offices anymore. I mean, they're all just very team-based, and they were hiring a CFO, and they had liked him. Something didn't feel right, but they were all ready to give him an offer. And at the end of the interview, he goes, hey, by the way, he's with my office. I'm like, oh, glad you asked. We'll show your office. And it's like right in the middle of the room, right? He's like, I don't have a private office. I'm like, well, no, this is your team, and this is the people you're working with every day. You want to be right next to him. He goes, I'm not interested. I need an office. And it was perfect. I mean, it didn't mean he was bad. It just, this isn't a fit for him, right? And so then when you really get this, the people that love it are just gravitated towards it. The people that don't aren't not bad people, but it's different. Right. But the people that love it, you don't get to experience it much. But if you ever had a great team, it's awesome. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is to have everybody think about the best team they've ever been in, or whatever it is, and then talk about what that was like. And it's fun because I look across the room as everyone's writing down what was great about that team, and everyone's got a smile on their face. You know, I'm like, wouldn't it be great if that team could be the team you spend most of your time with, which is at work for most people? Right? Mm-hmm. So to make that happen for people is awesome. Even though the success ratio is low, you just you need a victory every now and then. You're like, okay, I'm moving up, right? I believe it's going to happen.
Well, the success ratio being low, I think, is just proof of how difficult it is, and how, I mean, you know, buy-in from the whole team is just crucial, and if it's not there,
yep,
just doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't.
So one of the big projects we're working on this year is writing a book about purpose in marketing. So definitely a journey for us, a new journey for us, something outside of our comfort zone. What would you say is your purpose for doing what you do?
That's changed. That's a good question. In the very beginning, it was just make a living, right? And then it was, no, I want to help a leader. I mean, I think being a leader is so hard, just like being a parent. I mean, all your weaknesses show up in your kids. You know, as a leader, it's the same thing at work. And every day you get knocked down, and every morning you got to wake up and you go back to work. And I think being a leader is incredibly difficult. So for the longest time, my purpose was to help leaders do engage in one of the toughest acts there is, and that is to lead, right? I would tell you, in the past 5 years, my purpose has shifted slightly, and it's still that, right? And it's still very much a part of it. But a bigger part is, and I've said it before, but I am just convinced most organizations treat their employees like children. And then we get frustrated when they don't act like adults. And I'm convinced to my core, there's another way to run an organization. Because, you know, in every business, we got to make money. If we don't make money, we're not here. It's kind of like oxygen, right? But how you make money matters. And I do believe work is a vehicle for growth, and it can be a vehicle for growth. It doesn't just have to be this place where we earn a paycheck so we can go spend the rest of our life living, right? So why, if you're gonna run a company, why not run it in an adult fashion and create this environment where people can be the best versions of themselves? And so much of my purpose now is really helping leaders rethink, you know, how you run your business and do it in a way that allows people to become that best version of themselves. And it doesn't always, but more often than not, it means the destruction of the hierarchical model. Because as long as we're doing the hierarchical model, you're still, at the end of the day, when things start falling apart, we're in the parent-child model, right? So create a model on which we can function like adults, manage accountability with each other. You know, and again, the leader still has some. I'm not saying the leader ever has. The whole Rocketsy model of, hey, no one's going to be accountable, doesn't work, right? But there are ways of doing this in a way that allows people to be the best versions of themselves. And it, in all the generations, you know, it's just different for every generation. What I'm finding, actually, is the younger generations gravitate really well. And I think one of the reasons there's such the great resignation, the average, 10-year of anyone under 35 is a year and a half, because you're taking a round peg and putting it into a square hole. I mean, I was told, literally, as a kid, I mean, Eric, you start at the bottom and you work hard and you go here, and then you work hard and you get the next promotion, and that's the game you play. Well, these younger generations were saying, first of all, I'm not staying long enough to play that game. I saw my parents play that game. That didn't lead to a very happy outcome. I want to be part of something bigger than myself. I want flexibility. I want to be learning new things. I want autonomy, right? And they also want, they grew up in a world where they got feedback constantly. I mean, he's playing video games, constant feedback. And very rarely did it come from a dad. I mean, I was that dad. My daughter was in eighth place. I'm like, you tried hard, right? You know, there's that. Because I believed in that, right? But at the same time, now I realize, that probably wasn't the healthiest way in some ways. So, you know, she goes, true story, so going back a year, she's in college, but she just graduated, but she had a job all through college, and she called me up one day, and she goes, Dad, I'm thinking about quitting. I'm like, okay, cool, just curious, what's up? She goes, well, not sure if I'm doing a good job. Do you ask your boss? Because I did. What did he say? He said, I'm doing great. I'm like, Janet, what's the problem? She goes, well, that was 6 weeks ago. and it's just, she's just much more used to constant feedback, right? Mm-hmm. I need to know, am I on track or am I not on track? Well, in the business organization, typical business organization, you get feedback, what, once a year maybe, and it's from a person. But when you got a team that's functioning, you know, you can set the team up so you get constant feedback. Teams that are performing or not performing. And what the younger generations are really good at is working together to fix that, right? Because we did that with video games. We got together and we problem solved it, and they're exceptionalness. So this environment can work for any of the generations. You just got to learn to understand the generations and help them fit into it. My greater purpose now is to create adult organizations, I guess is probably the best way to put it. Because it allows people, I think, to be the best versions of themselves.
Right. Yeah. I love so much about your answer. And just recently we we're talking about this concept about how like success is infinite and purpose is constantly changing. You know, it's interesting how, you know, I feel like my career is still relatively young. I'm maybe getting to the middle of it. And what I once thought was like success or quote unquote making it, you know, like I did that at one point in time. And, you know, now looking back to where I thought I was when I quote unquote made it, it's like, oh man, I had so much more to do. And, you know, even, you know, today, like I feel like, hey, you know, things are going pretty well. I, you know, got a great team, great organization I'm working with and everything. But like, how long will it be before I look back at this and be like, yeah, I remember when you thought you made it, you know? So the, you know, that whole like continual shift and reevaluation of purpose and success and these things, I think is just so crucial to continued growth. And like you said, you know, especially, I mean, I do think every generation, but particularly younger generations, they need to know that, they need to feel it. It's got to be genuine.
Yes.
Or you lose them.
You lose them. Yeah. Cool.
Well, this has been an excellent conversation. I know you have a hard out, so we should get to our wrap up.
Before we do,
how can people learn more about you? How can they engage you and get your consulting? Or what else would you like to get people connected to?
Well, very often. And so you would reference the book. The book, actually, a publishing firm came to me. The president of a large publishing firm came to me. She heard me speak. She walked with me afterwards. She goes, do you have a book? I'm like, no. She goes, you need a book. I'm like, everyone tells me. And she goes, well, I'm president of the largest privately held publishing company in the country. And we have 6 divisions. And one of our divisions has been looking for unique material accountability and themes for years. And I think this is it. Love to, you know, to publish a book. But here's the deal. We also believe every business book is too long. So for 5 decades now, we only publish books that can be read an hour or less. So you've got 12,000 words. I don't think, well, that's a lot of words. That's no problem. Oh my gosh, that's not many words. Because there's so much to share and teach, right? So, but what I hope the book, the intention of the book is really just to kind of get you thinking at a high level about teams and kind of under conception and understanding. And a lot of times, it's not to sell the book, trust me, but it's about, you know, read it. And if this feels right to you, then let's talk. And some people are like, yeah, I get it, but no, nah, I'm like, perfect. You know, it's, if this is going to help you move forward in the direction you want to, or help you with the challenges you're facing your company, then let's talk. But if it isn't, you know, don't waste your time, because I don't have all the answers. And this isn't the ultimate solution for everybody. I'm not here to say the hierarchical model is wrong. I think it fits in certain environments. So usually step one is to kind of come to understanding what it is. And then if you're like, okay, interested from there, my website's accountableteams.com. So it's all one word, obviously, in plural. And my email is pretty much the same, Eric, E-R-I-C, at accountableteams.com. So you're always welcome to reach out. And it almost always starts with just a conversation. Okay, what are you struggling with? What are you looking for? And then decide, hey, is there really a cause to move forward? My goal is to make my involvement as minimal as possible. This, you don't want this to be a program of the month. What I really teach is more a structure and a language and a lot of skills, tool sets, right? A lot of this stuff comes down to how do you talk to each other? As you may remember from the training, there's a lot of crazy stuff I'll end up teaching. You can't ask questions without making statements first. You can't use group pronouns in meetings. I mean, some of the stuff you're like, what? But we want you to hear it and experience it. You're like, oh, wow, that's what allows us to have the really tough conversations and do so in a non-destructive way, right? So my goal is to help everyone understand the differences, but most importantly, give you the tool sets along the way. And then I'll, from that point forward, I'm almost always, I liken it to a river raft guide. I mean, you know, some people reach out to me occasionally, hey, we got this, we're pretty good, no matter what river it is. And some are like, no, we need you to kind of coach and maybe paddle sometimes too, right? And it's different with everybody. But more often than not, people don't end up needing me too much. I'm kind of there when they get in trouble. Like they hit this wall, like, all right, great. And not that I've been doing this so much, you just kind of know if the water gets moving fast, there's a bend to the left, the rocks are going to be in the right. So just anticipate this, right? Or I'll say, call George. George has been through exactly what you're talking about, and he'll give you some great insights. So that's kind of the role I play. But it's fun for me because, as I said, I get to experience so many different companies, which is and then hopefully help out.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we'll be sure to share all that info in our show notes and everything so people can connect to you directly. But as you said, we should transition to our wrap up, which is our Something Awesome segment, where we share recommendations for cool things we've experienced, heard, read, seen, and anything like that. So last call, Eric, I know you're winging it, so you got a little bit of time to think of something. I'll kick us off.
Besides this podcast, I mean, can I say this podcast?
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll take that. Does that
count? Anytime.
Yeah, we'll take that.
That sounds like a roundhouse comment. But no, it's so funny because I get asked to do a lot of podcasts. I don't always say yes. But when I found it, the name of the podcast was Awesomeology, I'm like, I'm in.
And that's love it.
Such a cool concept. I love it. Because now that I'm older, right? I mean, life is full of, peaks and valleys. It is for everybody. And when you're in the valleys, the last thing you want to hear is someone say life is awesome. But the older you get, the more you look back, you realize, life is awesome. And even the valleys were necessary to really appreciate and experience the peak. So I love the concept of awesomeology. I love the positivity. And as you get older, I just think it's just more and more important, and even through any point in your life, is to maintain that positivity and be awesome. So,
yeah.
If I were to say, I actually have something that fits. So a client of mine, believe me or not, gave me this last December, and it's called the Big Ass Calendar. If you guys have heard of this. So he gave me this thing as a Christmas present. He gave it to all his leaders. And what it is, I mean, now you can see it. It's a calendar in my office. It's, 3 feet by 4 feet. And it's got N rows every month, right? So it's 12 rows and then every day of the month, right? So in columns. And so each box is about the size of a post-it note. So it's a big ass calendar. And the concept behind it, whoever created it, was plan your awesome life. And that's not his term, but that's really kind of what it is. I don't want you to put Zoom meetings on this calendar. I want you to put the things you're really looking forward to. And I want you to put 4 things on here, 1 a quarter of something, your habit you're going to develop, right? So it's kind of the whole atomic habit notion, right? So drink more water, whatever it is. And I want you to put 6 things on here that you're going to do this year that you've never done before. So my wife and I were all over this, and we have the coolest big ass. I mean, it but it really forces you to be intentional about your life, right? And so we're like, you know what? And so we're going to do geocaching, and we're going to do rollerblading, and we got all these, and we had literally scheduled the day. On this day, we're going to do it, because if you don't schedule it, it doesn't happen, right? And then we put our vacations on there and bike trips and all this kind of stuff. And it really said, you know what, we're not doing anything cool in this time of the year. What can we do? And it's been a very intentional year.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan, and it's, wasn't much money, so I'm saying, hey, is the 2025 calendar out yet?
Yeah,
ready to go. So I would highly recommend it. I've actually had a few clients now that I've shared this use it in their work world. So they literally map out, they'll take a marketing department. So we know in middle of February we got to start this initiative because it's repeatable every year, right? So use that calendar to kind of map out your what your repeating workflow is throughout the year. So there's a lot of ways you can use it. So
yeah,
pretty awesome. It's been awesome.
That is, that is awesome. Love it. I knew that something would come to you naturally. I love it. That's perfect.
Well, this thing is staring me in the face every day.
Yeah. That's great. So for my Something Awesome, I'm going to share a link to an article in The Guardian that talks about this portal in New York City. And now it's not a literal portal where you can walk into it, but it is a digital portal between New York and Dublin, which it's basically just a live, like a live stream happening with, a camera on both ends, a big old screen on both ends, this cool circle shape. It was created by this artist named Benedictus Gillis. I'm probably butchering the name, but, it was this cool collaboration between, the city council in Dublin and a business group from Manhattan. And, really no point besides giving people this live view to these two cities on the other side of the planet. And, people being goofy. Of course, there were some things that went down when it first went live that were maybe a tad inappropriate, and people taking advantage of opportunities for self-promotion and things like that. But, with a little bit of guidance over it, some of that stuff's been cleaned up. And at the end of the day, it's just people being goofy with each other. And, it just feels so, like if you could show people 50 years ago what was happening through this thing, you know, like they would just be blown away. You know what I mean? So I just think it's so cool. And it just feels so human. And actually, the person who wrote the article, I'm going to read her quote directly, so I don't butcher it. She said, "I was laughing near constantly for hours with sheer fondness of how pathetically adorable humans are, basic humans are." You know, and I think, you know, to your point of like, you know, absorbing the awesome and positivity and things like that, I think like little moments that something like this could create where you can just look at other humans and be silly and stupid. We don't appreciate those enough. So that's a pretty cool thing.
Love it.
All right, Sue, top that.
Well, I'm gonna abruptly shift us and make sure that we represent a little bit of nerdy fandom in this and every episode, actually. And because the new season 1 of Doctor Who on Disney Plus has been released, I am a Whovian from way back, and I want to recommend, now that it is easily available here in the States on Disney Plus, that people check it out. We have a new Doctor. For anyone who doesn't know, Doctor Who is a longtime BBC series, and the main character can regenerate. So it's played by a different actor for seasons at a time. We have a brand new Doctor. Nchudi Gatwa is the new Doctor. He is the first Black Doctor. And he seems like an absolute delight. He brings, speaking of that awesome, great energy, he brings awesome, great, lovely, bubbly energy. So check it out. And as always, thank you to everyone who's listening. Thank you for joining us. Eric, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Especially since now we know you don't normally say yes to yes to too many podcasts. We feel very special.
Yeah.
This was a really good conversation. And if you would like to listen to any of our conversations about as we walked through Eric's book and the things that our team did, you can go back and check those out. 2023 episodes of our Accountable Team series. You can always catch us on your favorite podcast app, or you can find all of our episodes on our blog at exclamationcuso.com/blog.
Thanks again, Eric. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Be awesome, and we'll see you next time.
The Awesomeology Podcast is a production of Exclamation Services. Thanks to Nick Mulliver for sound production and Kylie Ganther for our cover artwork.
Executive producers are me, Ben Bauer, and my friend, Suzanne Campbell.